So here we are in our third sermon in this short series from the book of Judges. We've seen Ehud, the man of action, and last time Deborah, the woman of courage. Perhaps neither of those two judges were very familiar to you, but this week we've arrived at the story of Gideon. And if, like me, you went to Sunday school as a kid, or you had children's Bible stories read to you at bedtime, then you are certainly familiar with the story of Gideon. Now, whether you know the story or not, if you've kept up with the sermons in this series, then something else will be becoming familiar to you. That's the pattern that emerges as we study the book of Judges, and we see it time and time again. The pattern is this: the people sin. God sends judgment on them. They cry out to the Lord for relief. God raises up a judge. Israel is delivered. And they served the Lord for a period before eventually falling into sin again. And then the cycle repeats. That's the pattern. And in a way, it's kind of depressing in its predictability. And we have that pattern here. After the victory God gives under Deborah's hand in chapter 4, that was 2 weeks ago with Graham. And there in chapter 5, we have the song of praise that was issued forth because of the victory. We then see a time of peace. Just look back at that last line of chapter 5. Then the land had peace 40 years. 40 years of peace. That's just about long enough for a new generation to grow up. A new modern generation that knows the stories of God's blessings in history, but doesn't remember it for themselves. A new generation that discovers how attractive sin is, how old-fashioned the religion of their parents is, how modern it is to be in charge of our own lives. And so, chapter 6, verse 1, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And just like before, that angers God. And so verse 1 continues, and for 7 years the Lord gave them into the hands of the Midianites. This time the punishment is economic oppression, as the Midianites and the Amalekites routinely come in and strip the land of its food and its livestock. Remember, no tractors in those days, so somebody takes your donkeys away, you've got nothing to pull your plough. And this forced the Israelites into poverty, into near starvation, and they're hiding away in caves. Finally, they've had enough. They get to the end of their tether, and so in chapter 6, verse 6, they cried out to the Lord for help. Here's the beginning of the cycle again. And yet, we get a surprise here, don't we? According to the pattern, when the people cry out to God, God sends them a judge to deliver them. But not so here, at least not immediately, which introduces us to our first point tonight. God shows mercy by sending not his judge, but his word. God shows mercy by sending his word. A prophet, verse 8, not a judge, was God's reaction to their complaint. And verses 8 to 10 is the prophet's message, God's word to them. Now, do these verses sound familiar to you? Because they should. They're almost identical to the opening words of Exodus chapter 20, which we've been looking at these past few months in the mornings. A reminder to the people that they were slaves in Egypt, that God rescued and redeemed them from that slavery. So then an instruction to the people that they were to honour God in this covenant of being God's people. They were to have no other gods before them. But sadly, they didn't. What is the final pronouncement of the message of God's prophet? You have not listened to me. Does it seem rather odd to you that rather than send a deliverer, God sends a prophet to show the people their sin? Think about it. You're walking along at the seaside or perhaps by the canal or a river, and you see somebody in the water drowning. Are you going to stand on the side and lecture them on the need to learn to swim? That would be crazy, wouldn't it? Of course you wouldn't do that. You would throw them a life ring. So for God to send a prophet to lecture the people on their sin, that seems rather harsh of God, don't you think? The people are crying out for relief, God. They don't want a prophet. They want a judge. Why are you rubbing their noses in their failure? Harsh? No, far from it. This is not harsh. This is, in fact, the opposite. This is a great mercy that God sends his word. It speaks to their far deeper need. Their deepest need is not relief from the Midianite pain, but a true awareness of their sin. A real understanding that their idolatry has offended a holy God who judges. This prophet's message speaks truth that can change their hearts. One of the kindest things God does for us is to bring us under the criticism of his word, to expose our reasons for hopelessness and misery. It seems harsh at the time, but looking back, we see it for the blessing that it really is. And this truth is still valid today, which is surely why God has called us to and why we must preach the gospel, no matter how little the people want to hear it. Let me ask you, do you value the preaching of God's word into your life? Do you value it especially when it is uncomfortable, when it uncovers your sin? When it makes you squirm? Don't run from that. Don't hide from preaching when it speaks to you. It is a mercy to you that God speaks truth into your life. Of course, God didn't only speak his word into their situation. God did in fact send a judge to deliver them. Gideon was, and our second point is, chosen for service. Gideon was chosen for service. God comes to coax this leader out of obscurity. And as is so often with God, his ways are very different from our ways. So we're seeing a rash of leadership elections at the moment, aren't we? And what are the criteria for choosing a good leader? Well, we look for strong, tall, charismatic personalities. We look to establishments of reputation to produce our great leaders. We look to people with a track record of strong experience, people with an aptitude and experience and a desire to be a great leader. Not so, it seems, with God. Not many wise are chosen, Paul writes to the Corinthians. God chooses the weak over the strong. Man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. Later on, when God will guide Samuel to his chosen son of Jesse to choose a king, God signals out not the tallest, eldest son, the one with the most human honour, no, the youngest, the runt of the family, the shepherd boy out in the field. He is my chosen one, says God. Here the same principle is at work. To find his new leader, God comes to the weakest clan in Manasseh. He comes to the youngest son of the house, to Gideon. And boy, is Gideon an unlikely leader. He's far from heroic. What's he doing? He's hiding in the winepress, attempting to thresh grain in a hole in the ground, when really it needs an open space where the wind blows. Gideon's frightened silly of the Midianites. Here is the central theme of this story. Indeed, a central theme of redemption as a whole. God chooses weak vessels to achieve his ends, so that the glory might go to him, not us. It's a simple principle, but it's so very important for us to recognize it and acknowledge it and understand it, to live it. See, so I don't know whether you noticed, but many of Graham's illustrations for the past few weeks have been about football. I really don't know why. You'd have thought we'd have been in the midst of some sort of international major tournament or something. Anyway, not to be left out, I've got a football illustration for you tonight. So here we go. Do you remember being at school? And by the way, ladies, this applies to you as well. Maybe yours was netball or hockey, but mine was football. Got to the games lesson, PE, and there we were out in the field and we were going to play football. And so the PE teacher would appoint two of the class to be the captains of the football teams, and everybody else got to stand on the line, and the two captains took it in turns to pick their team players. And inevitably, the best footballers got picked first, and all the geeks, all the guys that were great at computers and maths, got left on the line till the last, didn't they? Looking more and more awkward, thinking, please don't let me be the last. But that's not how God picks his teams. If God were picking footballers for his team, I wouldn't be in the last three on the line. I'd be one of the first picked. Maybe he would even pick me to be one of the team captains. Not because I'm great at football. I'm rubbish at football. But because I'm rubbish at football, God would pick me. Hope I'm not being too insincere. You take my point, don't you? So when God picks his team of people to be Hope Church, to take Huddersfield for the gospel, did God pick the council leaders, the head teachers, the successful businessmen? Did he pick the chancellor of the university, the police inspectors, the great sportsmen of our town? Did he fill our church with rich, powerful, successful Huddersfield elite achievers? No. He picked out you and me, ordinary folk, people with small influence and ordinary backgrounds, people who don't have national or international influence. And so no wonder we feel ill-equipped for the task, because we are. Do you feel weak? Do you feel ineffectual? Most of us here didn't go to Eton. We didn't get a first-class degree from a Russell Group university. We're not top-notch company executives or politicians or board members of national bodies. When we face the task of preaching the gospel and witnessing this gospel to the wider town, we're tempted to look at our weaknesses and our insignificance. And because we're ill-equipped for the task ahead of us, we think we're going to fail. Gideon did. I'm not a leader, he said. Why have you come to me? But that's the whole point. We're not supposed to be strong in ourselves. If we were, we'd likely take credit for building a great church. Look at the church we've built. It's full of saved people in Huddersfield and we're brilliant. Just like when Jesus said to the Apostle Paul, my power is made perfect in weakness. Not many wise. And see how Gideon was changed by meeting the living God. See, after realizing that he was finally woke up to the fact that he was being commissioned in verse 17 of chapter 6. So Gideon hurriedly rustles up a meal for his visitor, which is then bizarrely consumed as an offering in verse 21. And Gideon finally twigs who's been speaking to him. He feels undone. Look at verse 22. He's like, I've seen the Lord. I'm going to die. But God speaks grace. Verse 23. God speaks grace into his life. God says to him, peace. Don't be afraid, Gideon. You're not going to die. Meeting with God changed Gideon. brought him peace, gave him an assurance of life. It produced a faith response as Gideon went on to build an altar to the Lord. Verse 24. Did you hear what the writer said? Obviously not now, but when this was being written. And it's still there to this day. A testimony to Gideon's faithfulness. Do you know that peace that can only come from a personal encounter with the living God? Have you got a saving faith like Gideon? This isn't a relationship you can inherit from your parents or your pastor or your Sunday school teacher. It has to be found between you and the living God personally. You'll know when you have it because you will find peace with God and rest for your soul. Those who find salvation and peace through an encounter with the living God are called to a life of obedience and holiness. And so Gideon immediately faces this challenge of holiness. For later the same day, not much of a honeymoon period here, is there? Later the same day, God says to Gideon that he's got to get rid of his father's altar to Baal, verse 25. Ooh. Seriously, Lord, thinks Gideon, destroy my father's altar to Baal? It's a scary thing to do. Gideon knows that this isn't going to go down too well with the townsfolk, but do it he must if he's to keep the first commandment. God is uncompromising in this area. He demands all of our hearts. This is a big initial test for timid Gideon. And wow, he passes it. Albeit doing the destructive deed at night. God calls each one of us to personal holiness. Yes, it's okay to be timid and afraid. But it's not okay to be disobedient and two-time the living God. Are you, like Gideon, measuring up to the challenge of personal holiness and obedience before God? So, appointed by God to be a mighty warrior, Gideon's hour approaches as the Midianites and the Amalekites come over the river Jordan into the valley of Jezreel. This is verse 33 of chapter 6. And God's spirit comes upon Gideon and he gathers the various tribes together to form his Israelite army to contend with the invaders. And yet, even with the Spirit of God in him, Gideon is still weak in faith. He is still timid. He's not the mighty man of valor. He's a bit nervous. Does God abandon him because of his faltering faith? No. Here we come to our third point. Gideon finds grace for those weak in faith. Grace for those weak in faith. Perhaps we'd like to think that if we just do this thought experiment. You've been personally commissioned by the angel of the Lord himself, who physically comes to you. Do you think you'd have a bigger faith than you've got now? The living God rocks up and tells you he's with you, consumes your food offering in a blaze of glory, that fire that came from the rock. I think that'd create pretty strong faith, don't you? I think we'd hope that we would have a level of trust that would make us effective if that had actually happened to us. But it didn't with Gideon, did it? And maybe the reality is with us too that it wouldn't either. His faith is still weak. Our faith is often weak. Gideon needs confirmation of the promise. He famously lays out the fleece, not just once, but twice, with opposite success criteria to rule out a fluke of nature. Gideon wants to be certain of the promise, and then he wants to be certain of the certainty of the promise. To use a more modern meaning of the word, has Gideon been fleeced of his earlier faith? Is it wrong for Gideon to have weak faith? Well, lots and lots of people think so. There have been much criticism of his fleece-laying antics over the centuries. But look, you heard it read tonight in its entirety. There is no explicit condemnation of this fleece-laying. Not in Scripture. Not that this is a model for us to discern God's will in our lives either. See, remember, this is a historical narrative we're reading. This describes what happened to Gideon. It doesn't prescribe what should happen to Christians. We, especially, have a greater revelation of God's goodness to us in Jesus Christ, and far clearer promises of God's blessing on us and presence with us than Gideon had. And there's even a hint in the verses here that Gideon knows he's kind of stretching God's patience. Look there in verse 39. Gideon says, "Don't be angry, Lord," as he asks again. You can almost see him squirming a bit. And yet, what a wonderful reassurance Gideon receives. God is so patient with him. Is God patient with us? Yes. God is so kind to Gideon, so condescending, so gracious. Is that your experience of the living God? Because it is mine. He longs to give us assurance. He longs to build our faith. Be confident to trust God. Take him at his word. Bring your timidity to the Lord. Ask him to confirm for you and to you that he is faithful and true in all that he has promised. And God will not turn away your weak and timid faith. He instead will confirm it and grow it and strengthen it. No matter that your faith is as small as a mustard seed, just so long as it's real faith in the gracious living God. And so Gideon proceeds to battle, much more confident in his calling. And yet, still things are not going to plan. Still God is not finished with Gideon. God knows that if a confident Gideon succeeds with his army, there is a very real danger that he's going to be proud of his achievement. So to prevent this, God interferes with Gideon's plans. Has God ever interfered with your plans? God sent Gideon a hard providence. He said to him, "Gideon, you have too many soldiers." Just think about that for a minute. Too many soldiers. "Lord, are you insane? Don't you know the first thing about warfare? Overwhelming force is the doctrine of success. Shock and awe wins the battle. A troop surge is the key to dominance on the battlefield. Too many soldiers? You've lost your mind, Lord. You can't have too many soldiers." We don't know whether those were Gideon's thoughts, but do you recognise your own thoughts in similar circumstances? Because I recognise mine. And yet, God's ways are not our ways. God's logic often flies in the face of the common sense of human wisdom. God calls us to difficult places, to hard places. Do you see that in your own life? Are you in, have you been in, situations where you wonder what God is doing? Your version of too many soldiers, Lord, really? But this is how it always was and how it always will be with God. Trust means following God even when it looks like he's lost the plot. God never loses the plot. It's just that he always has a better, bigger one, and he often hides it from us. And we mostly struggle to see that and acknowledge it, but it's often true. But again, see the tender graciousness of God. He knows that facing an army of 135,000 men, well, facing it with 32,000 men looks pretty hard. Facing it with 300 frankly looks like a suicide mission. And so God grants Gideon a kind providence. He tells him in chapter 7 and verse 9, Gideon, sneak down to the enemy camp so that you can learn something and be encouraged. What a merciful and kind providence to Gideon. God knows Gideon's fears, even though God has constantly reassured him of success. Do you recognize that God is kind in this way? Has he blessed you with similar kind providences in your experience? Words of encouragement from others, or sometimes even amazingly providential circumstances when you are blessed by unbelievers in an obvious working of God's sovereignty in your life. Our response to all such kind providences should be the same reaction that we see here from Gideon in chapter 7, verse 15, where Gideon bowed down and worshipped. God is kind. It also had an encouraging effect. It gave Gideon an enormous spur to action. Imagine how fast his feet flew back up that mountainside. And hear the confidence in his voice. Get up! Get up! The Lord has given the Midianites into our hands! Such should be our encouragement when God smiles kind providences into our life. They are designed to move us to worship and to spur you to action in the Lord's service. So the attack ensues. Gideon and his men, assisted further by God's wonderful providential timing, we witness the Midianites waking up and being convinced that those who were returning from the middle watch are themselves attacking the camp. Wonderfully timed by God. So chaos ensues. Verse 22 of chapter 7 tells us, explicitly, God caused the Midianites to turn on each other. The enemy are routed. Gideon's band pursue them. They win a mighty victory. Chapter 8, verse 10 tells us that 120,000 of them fell that day. God gave Gideon and his men a mighty, mighty victory. And yet, in spite of the circumstances, with so much obvious help from God, still the people want to honour Gideon as the architect of the victory. We didn't have time to read it earlier on, but if you look down the page to chapter 8, verse 22, it tells us the people asked Gideon to be king over them. That is a sad reflection of their spiritual hardness. They would rather trust a human leader to lead them and win their battles for them, rather than looking to and trusting in the living God. This is a warning to us. And so in conclusion, we need to say, finally, we have feet of clay. We have feet of clay. See, Gideon was still a sinner for all his mighty victory. He was still prone to pride, just like we are. Though he appears to turn down their overtures to be their king, Gideon immediately starts living like one. He gathers their gold earrings and he uses them to make an ephod. An ephod is an object used to define God's will on a decision. And so, on the face of it, that looks like a God-honoring thing to do. Use this and find God's will for your lives. But our human hearts are twisted and sinful. Do you know what? We love a thing to be the object of our worship. And this is how it turned out with the ephod. Chapter 8, verse 27. All Israel prostituted themselves by worshipping it, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. This is a warning to us. All men are sinners. We all have feet of clay. Ultimately, we cannot and should not look to any man or anything for our salvation. All will disappoint, all save for one. Recall right at the beginning, our first point was that God shows mercy by sending us his word to convict of sin and to reveal our hearts to us. For us, we see the truth of this with far greater clarity than Gideon and his contemporaries did. For we have seen the Word made flesh and dwell among us. We have seen his glory. The glory of the one and only came from the Father, full grace and truth. If God is merciful to send a prophet to speak his word, how much more merciful for him to send us his own Son, that he should be made sin for us, so that we might be the very righteousness of God. We all have feet of clay. We're all sinners, even the best of us. But the greatest judge of all is Jesus. And in him and him alone will we have the victory over our evil opponents and over the sin that dwells within. Make Jesus your king. And just like Gideon, you too can be a mighty warrior for the kingdom of heaven. Amen.